Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect welcomes Dr. Kenneth Friedman. He's a retired medical school professor, are you?
Yes.
And the treasurer of the International...
It's the International Association for Chronic Fatigue Syndrome /ME.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You were at the conference in Ottawa. I understand one of the things that came out of the conference was further support for a new name. And I know people with chronic fatigue syndrome or ME have been fighting for a new name for 25 years. Is that fair?
I think so. The name chronic fatigue syndrome trivializes the severity of the illness, and it doesn't really get to the cause,
no,
or even a possible cause of the illness. And so patients would like their illness to indicate the level of severity of the illness and possibly a potential cause.
Yeah.
And so CFS does neither of those things.
Okay.
But at this particular meeting, evidence was provided for multiple organic causes of chronic fatigue syndrome, but was particularly intriguing was that a name which the patients particularly like, which is myalgic encephalomyelitis,
mm-hmm.
Now has some substantial documentation as to actually existing.
That myalgia name, is pain, isn't it?
Myalgia is a diffuse pain of muscle.
Okay.
Via myalgia.
Okay.
Encephalomyelitis, itis implies inflammation.
Right.
Encephalo means brain, myelo means brain tissue,
okay,
or some of the brain tissue, and this conference did provide some evidence that you can document inflammation in the brain. Prior to this, there have been many studies, but they did not indicate that it was inflammation per se,
okay,
which is what that name ME implies.
Okay.
So that this was exciting in that there was finally confirmation of that particular kind of abnormality or pathology that is present in the brain.
So to hear you talk about it, what was in doubt was not the abnormalities in the brain. What was in doubt was that it was caused by inflammation, and the concept myalgic encephalomyelitis encompassed both ideas, and so was in doubt because one of them was not established?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
All right.
Yep. In the United States, there was just a very recent, I'm going to use the term battle, with regard to the ICD, because the U.S. government was going to place chronic fatigue syndrome as a somatoform disorder as opposed to maintaining it as a neurological disorder. And so a group of organizations banded together, wrote a very long scientific argument as to why chronic fatigue syndrome should not be considered a somatoform disorder, but rather a neurological disorder, and went to essentially an appeal hearing in Baltimore, Maryland, on September 14th, and presented their argument and their document. And what we were told is that based upon the strength of that document and the scientific arguments, that in fact chronic fatigue syndrome would be retained as a neurological disorder and not moved into a somatoform disorder. So so we're very pleased with that, but we certainly want to maintain that from this point going forward.
Yeah, what's the difference between neurologic and somatoform?
Well, somatoform is more of a psychological or psychiatric disorder that indicates that it's a diffuse syndrome with no known mechanism that's behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, at least in the United States, when that kind of disorder is given that kind of recognition, then it will be treated as a psychological or as an it's all in your head
right.
kind of disorder, rather than be treated or symptomatically treated for the pathophysiologies or the biological errors that are occurring in the body.
Right.
And so there is less likelihood that patients are going to get the kinds of symptomatic relief based upon the symptoms that they have, rather that people will try to provide medications that work only in the brain to modify their mood or modify how they feel about their illness, rather than getting to the actual causes or symptoms of how they feel.
That's been a common approach in the States, hasn't it? I don't know that it's been so common elsewhere. Do you know, do you have any, are you allowed to speak?
England.
Is it?
Yes,
okay.
Yes. And
behavior
England
modification?
Much worse than the United States.
Behavior modification and so forth?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And those physicians who treat outside of the box are subject to lose their licensure.
Well, they were in the past in Canada. They may still be, for all I know.
I do not know the situation in Canada, but I know there is an ongoing battle for one physician, which is information about which is available on the internet. And at this particular meeting in Ottawa, I was informed of another case that is going on.
Is it Canadian
that
doctor?
Has not received the attention of the first.
One's an English doctor. The other is what, Canadian?
No, the other, both of them are English.
Oh, okay.
But one of them is rather public.
Okay.
And the other is rather private. So it has not garnered the attention on the internet of the more public one.
So if you wanted to Google them.
I was assured that it's just as severe, that this individual practitioner is about to lose his license unless he agrees to treat only using a psychological approach.
Oh, no.
And to apologize for attempting to treat more symptomatically in the past.
Oh, dear. And if someone wanted to uncover these two cases on the web, what search words would you use?
I don't think there, to my knowledge, there isn't anything about the second one. The first one is Sarah Myhill. M-Y-H-I-L-L.
Okay.
First name Sarah, and I believe it's S-A-R-A-H.
So as the other one comes into the open, I would expect to find it linked to Sarah Myhill's experience so that a
public,
search for the
right.
one would reveal both.
Right, right. But this gets to the issue of people who work in the field of chronic fatigue syndrome being the subject of prejudice and being discriminated against.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you're aware of it, but I believe it was something like May 16th or April 16th. There was a State of Knowledge workshop in the United States about chronic fatigue syndrome, and I presented a position paper about the status of chronic fatigue syndrome researchers and educators and clinicians, at least in the United States. But I did mention one European researcher who effectively lost his job because he was doing research on chronic fatigue syndrome.
Geez, I thought the days when we beheaded or excommunicated scientists were, you know, years in the past.
That isn't true. And in the United States, one of the organizations that I work for is an organization called the Vermont CFIDS Association.
Okay.
And they have, this year, released a film which is called Invisible, And in that film, there is the story. One of the stories that's in that film is the story of a physician who had practiced in Burlington, Vermont, which is the largest city in Vermont. And when he announced that he was ill with chronic fatigue syndrome, excluding the support of his family, he lost everything.
Really?
He lost his practice, the medical long-term disability insurance that he had been paying for 17 years, refused to pay long-term disability.
Really?
Because it said, or the company said, that in the fine print it had excluded chronic fatigue syndrome as one of the reasons for which it would pay.
Really?
And he lost his friends, his physician friends. And so all that he was left with was the friendship of his family.
Really?
And his testimony in that film, in that documentary, is rather compelling. And this is a story that is not uncommon, not only to physicians, but also to nurses. If you announce that you have chronic fatigue syndrome, you cross that invisible line of being a colleague practitioner to being one of those people who are on the other side, who are feigning illness.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there is a conceit in the medical profession, and it varies from practitioner to practitioner. Some of them don't embrace it. Some of them embrace it as if it were a religion. But it's that if you can't fix it, then it's not a medical concern.
Well, I think the underlying thing is if you don't have a diagnostic test for it, then it doesn't exist.
All right. Yeah, I can see that. Even a test of exclusion, eh?
Well, there is no test of exclusion because if you can't find something wrong and the patient says, but I am sick, then what is the physician supposed to do? Either you believe that the patient is telling the truth or you do not.
All right.
I can tell you that in the pediatric population, those children who become sick, if they maintain that they are sick without a physician being able to confirm by some diagnostic test that they are sick, then the physicians and social services blame the parents.
Okay.
And they literally take the children away from the parents. They put them in foster care.
Oh, dear. And this is in the States.
And this is in the States, yeah. And then it is a struggle, if it is even at all possible, for the parents to attempt to regain the custody. And we just went through one of these battles last year. And fortunately, due to the intervention of several patient advocate groups and the ability of several of these groups to support the parents by providing some financial resources and legal advice, the child was eventually reunited with his parents. And in fact, there is still some ongoing litigation because the child was actually abused in foster care.
That's not
what
uncommon.
What happened was that the government agency that removed the child from the home said that there was nothing wrong with the child, and even though this child had a documented cardiac condition, the foster parents were told not to believe that. And so they forced the child to climb stairs. They took away the child's wheelchair. Uh-huh. They forced him to perform physical exertion beyond his limits and actually made the child much more ill.
Okay.
Much like the situation that happened in England, which is also detailed in another documentary, which is called, I believe it's called Voices in the Mist.
All right.
Where a child was taken away from the parents, put into a psychiatric facility, because that's what they do in England. The child was forced to do physical activity that made the child much worse. Eventually, the parents were able to regain custody of the child. But by that time, the damage had been done. And so the child actually died.
And there was no legal resolution of this?
there was no legal resolution, because what was done was that the powers that be were carrying out the procedures that were mandated by the state.
I see. Okay.
So the only thing that can be done is to make what happened known and then try to change the procedures so that it doesn't happen to other children.
Yeah. I think with that, we'll take a break. The writer, Lucinda Shodan, the musician, Dave Clark, the group, Steel Rail, Midnight Road.
Tonight, I could not sleep. Put on my coat and found the street. Cold to the bone. And all alone, I'm walking that midnight road. There's a dog, he's restless too. So he sings me sad and blue. It's the only sound in this old town.
Did the conference hold out hope for any of these situations in its attempts to change the view of chronic fatigue and of new research?
I think we all, both patients and researchers and healthcare providers, left the conference with a much more positive attitude. And I think that's because we all left knowing that it is still a puzzle and that we do not have the answers or the know all the pieces of the puzzle, but that we are devising a method or methods of working with the pieces of the puzzle. For example, there are now at least four different definitions of chronic fatigue syndrome, and we think we have a relatively good research definition of chronic fatigue syndrome. And we think we have a pretty good definition for diagnosing and treating chronic fatigue syndrome.
Care to share any of those?
Well, the research definition that seems to be used is something called the Fukuda case definition, Fukuda et al., which dates back to 1994.
All right.
And that definition has been used since that date forward. It is much more restrictive a case definition than one would like to see used on patients.
Right.
But it helps to define a patient population that is relatively suffering from similar symptoms.
Okay.
And so therefore, for research purposes, you're apt to get results that are more clearly defined.
So it's a conservative definition, yeah.
Pardon?
Conservative definition.
A conservative definition.
Yeah.
That may exclude some patients.
Right.
And therefore is not workable in a clinical situation.
So the clinical definition?
In a clinical situation, you want something that is a more relaxed or a more inclusive definition.
Yeah.
And there are actually a couple of those. There's what's called the Canadian case definition.
Right.
Which was developed in 2003, 2004, and that seems to be very good at identifying patients and their key symptoms and having them diagnosed as having chronic fatigue syndrome. And then there is a brand new one that is developed in 2011 that is now being called the International Case Definition. And that one is essentially too new for anyone to really have any sense of how it will fare as either a patient case definition or as a research case definition.
Okay.
But what seems to have happened at this meeting is that there seems to be agreement that we will collect data or get information from each patient that will permit us to diagnose patients using several of these case definitions.
Really?
So that the information will not be lost, and so that we will then, in retrospect, be able to see which case definition works best, both in the clinical situation and in the research situation.
Okay.
And that's a much more mature, intelligent approach than trying to squeeze all patients into one particular case definition.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously excluding some patients from treatment because they don't fit this particular case definition.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the interesting papers that was presented at this meeting was by a clinician. I believe he's at GW in near Washington, D.C.,
What he did was
sort of a courageous thing. What he did was he took his chronic fatigue syndrome patients,
yeah,
and he treated them for Lyme disease.
Oh yeah,
and approximately a third of them improved, their physical condition improved when treated for Lyme disease. And it's not sure exactly what that means. We're not sure whether that means that approximately one-third of the patients in his patient population had Lyme disease and were just missed with the Lyme disease diagnosis,
right,
but when they were treated for Lyme disease actually improved,
right,
or whether the actual or their particular kind of chronic fatigue syndrome is susceptible to improvement by the same antibiotics that are used in the treatment of Lyme disease.
All right.
So that there is at least potential overlap between chronic fatigue syndrome and other illnesses.
I see. And this came out at the conference as well.
And this is something that needs to be looked at much more carefully.
Okay. And you spoke of multiple causes, too, or multiple origins.
Yes, I do believe that there are multiple origins. And I believe that the majority of the clinicians and researchers at this meeting were coming to that point of view, because there are a number of infectious agents that have been found to be initiators of the illness cycle in patients. One of the names, former names of chronic fatigue syndrome was chronic Epstein-Barr virus.
Right.
And now there is work to show that patients who get sick with other viruses also develop chronic fatigue syndrome.
Okay.
HHV6, for example, yep. And enterovirus.
Right.
If patients do not recover from these viral infections, they can develop chronic fatigue syndrome.
Okay.
So that it would appear that chronic fatigue syndrome is essentially the body's response, or perhaps the body's immunological response to an infection that isn't cleared from the body, which might argue that the people in whom this occurs have immune systems that are unable to clear these infections.
Right.
And therefore, chronic fatigue syndrome actually represents an immune system abnormality or defect, because these patients lack the ability to clear these infections from their body.
And they have an immune system what? Inability?
Inability or defect.
Okay.
To clear these infections from their body, and so they persist.
Yeah, I think immune abnormalities have long been found in chronic fatigue patients, haven't they?
Immune abnormalities have been found. The problem is that there isn't one consistent finding.
Okay.
And perhaps the reason for that is that there are these subcategories of chronic fatigue syndrome patients.
Right.
And that if we define the right subcategory of chronic fatigue syndrome patient, then we may be able to find a clear, uniform, distinct pattern of immunological abnormalities in a subset, in this particular subset of chronic fatigue syndrome patients.
I see. So then the job becomes defining the subsets.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And researchers are beginning to turn their attention to that. And some of the questionnaires that are being developed to screen chronic fatigue syndrome patients are beginning to ask questions that will assist us in being able to differentiate the subgroups and perhaps the infective agents that are precipitating chronic fatigue syndrome in these patients.
So this is a hypothetical, broad immune response to neurological agents of possibly many origins, with a common human adaptation to it, which involves fatigue and neurological abnormalities in consequence. Am I correct?
Well,
is this what's hypothesized?
The agents are believed to be infective. They don't necessarily have to be neurological.
Okay.
Although some of them may be.
But the response is neurological.
There is another theory that's beginning to go around now, and that is that if infectious agents are not cleared from the body, they can establish themselves in one or more of what's termed the body systems. For example, the gastrointestinal tract,
right,
or the central nervous system,
right,
or in the cardiovascular system.
Yeah.
So that we're now beginning to see at least the suggestion that things like cardiovascular disease or hardening of the arteries or the deposition of plaque in the arteries is not only caused by the deposition of cholesterol, but might also be the reaction to some bacteriological agent that has been deposited in the blood vessels, and therefore the plaque is an attempt to cover up or seal off those kinds of infections.
Yeah.
And so chronic fatigue syndrome, in an analogous manner, may be a reaction that is akin to that kind of mechanism.
Yeah. There are so many effects. And now you say there are so many agents.
Well, the idea is to tease them out. I'm pretty excited by it, because I think what we're beginning to see is a whole new area opening up to us about how infection invades the body and the consequences of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so that what we discover about chronic, what I would call hidden infections in the body, will be applicable to a whole variety of diseases and answer a lot of questions that have been around for a long time but have never been answered before.
Particularly,
and this will
chronic,
give us a tool, a mechanism of possibly providing answers to these questions.
Oh, great.
Yes.
What else came out of the conference that you took away?
What I took away from the conference is first of all, the willingness to work with multiple questions that lead to the possibility of diagnosing patients by multiple case definitions.
Okay.
I think there is a renewed excitement in the involvement of the brain in chronic fatigue syndrome because there is now more evidence of different kinds. I think there is also a lot more work in the area of genetics and chronic fatigue syndrome.
No.
People are looking at genes being turned on, being turned off in what I call the subsets or some subsets of chronic fatigue syndrome versus, quote, normal subjects.
Yep.
They're being able to find differences or particular genes being turned on and turned off.
Right.
And based upon that, they're looking for proteins that or protein differences or differences in concentrations of proteins between patients and
right.
normal controls.
Yeah.
And so we are beginning to see what the differences are.
Really?
Between normal controls and patients with chronic fatigue syndrome.
That's exciting.
And this is all very exciting because eventually we will be able to understand the differences between normal healthy people and chronic fatigue syndrome patients by understanding the difference in the molecules that they are producing. And
right.
once we do that, we should be able to alter or change back or normalize
wow.
the molecules that they are producing that are producing their symptoms.
Wow. That sounds quite in line with current research, too. It doesn't sound far afield.
No, it's not far afield. And what it means is that there is new excitement and that the field of chronic fatigue syndrome is keeping up with the more advanced technologies, and people are beginning to apply those technologies to the field of chronic fatigue syndrome. Not only are they beginning to apply it to the field, but they are actually obtaining results, significant results, that will eventually lead to better treatments.
Okay. The American organization Pandora has introduced us to Dr. Kenneth Friedman, a professor in pharmacology and physiology, and a researcher in chronic fatigue who has been attending the conference in Ottawa in September of this year. Talk to us about advances in both the treatment and the perspective of chronic fatigue syndrome in society. Take a break with me again. Steel Rail, lead vocals, this time by Todd Gore, 1,000 Miles of Snow.
Snow needles in the headlights, cold moon knows the way I feel. It was snowing in Toronto when I got behind the wheel, and 12 hours on the road, now the flakes still coming down. 3 more days of blacktop till I'm back in my hometown. I'm driving home, I'm driving home through 1,000 miles of snow. Drifts dancing across the highway, static on the radio. I'm in Walk That Lonesome Valley, so I don't feel so alone. I left a life behind when I went east so many years ago. Now this empty road will take me back to faces I won't know. I'm driving home, I'm driving home across 1,000 miles of snow. wish each time these wipers are, they'd sweep a week away. And in the center of the city, still heard that west wind blow. Now this old sled sits and my regrets will take my heart back home. I'm driving home, I'm driving home, across a thousand miles of snow. Driving home, yes I'm driving home, across a thousand miles of snow.
Where is the leading edge of the research and the treatment right now?
I believe the leading edge of research and treatment will be in two areas. One will be in the neurological, in the involvement of the brain, and the other will be in the genetics and the proteins, or what's called the proteomics of chronic fatigue syndrome. Those, to me, at this point, seem to be the two most promising areas. And again, those are the areas that are keeping up with the most sophisticated methods of treating all diseases and trying to make gains in all diseases.
Which is why you said chronic fatigue was keeping up. In other words, it's in the mainstream of research to treat diseases.
That's correct. At the meeting, we had people, granted mostly from the United States, some from Canada, some from Norway, Japan, Australia, New Zealand. There was one fellow there from France. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid I'm going to leave someone out, and I may be chided for it. But you know, essentially, the research is coming in from all over the world. There was a fellow there from Spain who presented a lovely paper in a session that I chaired. So I believe it's all over the world.
There's an initiative, the Chronic Fatigue Initiative, that's attracted prominent professionals that have been treating chronic fatigue, some of them for as long as 20, 25 years. Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, the Chronic Fatigue Initiative is relatively new.
Okay.
And I don't think that they are at the point where they are actually expending grants.
Okay.
The board of the IACFSME did meet with the folks that run the initiative, and what we were told is that they wish to stimulate chronic fatigue syndrome research, and they are at the point where they are gathering information to essentially determine the status of chronic fatigue syndrome research. And what they will be doing is formulating a series of questions that they believe will most quickly and expeditiously provide initial research results that will stimulate other research that will provide treatment and get at the cause of chronic fatigue syndrome. And once they have formulated those questions, that they will put out a request for proposals to address those particular questions about chronic fatigue syndrome. So it's going to be a very targeted program based upon what they feel will be the most productive research challenges that need to be addressed in order to quickly get to treatment and potential cures of chronic fatigue syndrome.
All right.
And I should add that there is another organization that is coming out of the gate, if you'll permit me to use that term, and that is called Cimarron Research, which is headed up by a group of people who are of a similar mind, namely to promote research in chronic fatigue syndrome that will yield results in a short time frame. And the director of this program is a well-known internist by the name of Dan Peterson.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And Dan has been working with chronic fatigue syndrome patients for, I guess, somewhere between 25 and 30 years.
He's in Nevada, isn't he?
Pardon?
He's in Nevada, isn't he?
Yes. All yes, right. In Klein Village.
Okay.
And so he has been, I guess, the resource that is responsible for the formation of Cimarron.
Right.
And again, you know, this is another venue for stimulating research. And of course, we also have the Whitmore Peterson Institute,
right,
where Annette Whittemore, also with the assistance of Dan Peterson, has established a research institute. And they certainly have shaken up the field of chronic fatigue syndrome and stimulated a lot of research about chronic fatigue syndrome with their initial finding of XMRV in a large percentage of a defined patient population with chronic fatigue syndrome. So, you know, these are new players, as I would call them,
right,
to the field of chronic fatigue syndrome that will bring an element of excitement and hopefully will accelerate chronic fatigue syndrome research, not only by virtue of their own investments into chronic fatigue syndrome research, but also by stimulating the federal government to pay attention and to also put in more funds for chronic fatigue syndrome in order to balance out these private research efforts.
All right. Federal governments everywhere. You hear that? Pay attention. You mentioned XMRV, too, and I think that was dealt with ambivalently at the conference, wasn't it? There was one research program.
Oh, I
program.
Wouldn't characterize it as ambivalence. I would say that there are a number of findings that put the initial, I believe, 2009 science paper into doubt.
Right.
The Whitmore Peterson Institute and its, I would characterize her as the lead researcher, Judy Mikovits,
mm-hmm,
still maintains that there are many questions generated by their initial finding that have not been addressed by the papers that have come out subsequently that tend to characterize their initial findings as being negative.
All right.
And that before the issue of XMRV is fully understood, that much more research has to be done, that the Whitmore Peterson Institute is continuing to do research on XMRV,
okay,
and so are many other laboratories in an attempt to understand what is the relationship of XMRV to chronic fatigue syndrome. And now, if the results of presented at this particular conference are to be believed, the relationship of XMRV to a lot of cells in culture,
right,
and possibly even to a lot of vaccines that are currently being used throughout the United States and throughout the world, as a matter of fact. So the situation is far from resolved. It begs to be resolved.
Okay.
And hopefully it will be resolved.
All right. So what I described as ambivalence is described by people like Judy Mikovits as a need to resolve unresolved implications that the research has uncovered.
Correct.
Okay. So ambivalence wouldn't describe the researcher's attitude at all.
No, I don't think there is ambivalence. You know, it depends upon how you wish to view Judy's data. If you look at it one way, it pertains to chronic fatigue syndrome. If you look at it another way, it has consequences throughout the world and throughout laboratories who do tissue culture throughout
okay.
the world.
All right.
There was one report there that XMRV is a contaminant that has contaminated commercial products that are used in tissue culture.
Okay.
And if that's the case, if that proves to be the case, then the implication is of tremendous impact and of tremendous consequence to tissue culture and all the research that is done using tissue culture. And if that is the case, then Judy Mikovits needs to be applauded for what she has done
for uncovering
terms of uncovering this contamination, which is far beyond anyone's initial expectation.
Okay. So its relationship to chronic fatigue is still unestablished.
The relationship to chronic fatigue syndrome is still unestablished, and the initial, I would go so far as to say that the initial hypothesis has been called into question.
Okay. All right.
But it remains unresolved.
All right. What would you like to summarize your experience at the conference with before we close?
I think it was a great conference. I think that the world is paying more attention to chronic fatigue syndrome. I think that chronic fatigue syndrome, as demonstrated at this conference, there is a huge amount of very promising data. And there was a summary of this conference provided by Tony Komaroff, which is a name that people who have been following chronic fatigue syndrome research will be familiar with. He's a well-respected chronic fatigue syndrome researcher and commentator.
Right.
And he provided the overall summary. And at the end of it, he was asked the question, which of these projects do you think deserves the most attention? And his statement in response was that they all do. They are all exceedingly promising results. And I agree with that. The only thing I would add to it is that these are all exceedingly promising results done on relatively few patients with relatively or comparatively relative small budgets.
Right.
And that there needs to be an infusion of much more money into these studies now that their promise has been shown. I think that as we have all learned, based upon the jumping in of these few new benefactors to chronic fatigue syndrome, is that we cannot rely solely on federal governments to support chronic fatigue syndrome. That we need benefactors, but benefactors are few and far between. And so I believe that the patient population or patient populations throughout the world really do need to get more involved and support these kinds of research. And now with the advent of what is termed social media, people are getting on social media and saying, tomorrow is my XX birthday, and instead of sending me gifts because I am a patient, send money to this or that research institute or send money to this organization to fund clinical care services. And that, I think, is the only way that we will be able to achieve the magnitude of funding that we will need to be able to make chronic fatigue syndrome understood in terms of pathophysiology, to make it treatable with definitive treatments in a time frame that will benefit the patients to have it now. Who have it now.
I appreciate that point of view. It's quite compelling. Perhaps, and only perhaps, because I'm not personally acquainted, but I understand the attitude with our federal government is that we're not going to be able to meet our need for skilled workers in the near future by immigration alone, that we need to expand the number of people who work past retirement, and that in that light, they might be willing to look at something like chronic fatigue as limiting a great number of the population who could contribute to the workforce and the tax base in the future.
Well, it would be wonderful if any federal government would be willing to put more money into chronic fatigue syndrome. I think that in most countries, it's the patients who have to advocate for greater federal funding. not only do we need to keep older researchers working in chronic fatigue syndrome, but we need to somehow stimulate new researchers into the field of chronic fatigue syndrome, which raises the whole issue of how do you do that?
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, chronic fatigue syndrome, because it is an underfunded area of research, most young researchers, when looking for a career in research, are not going to go there. They're going to go to the better funded areas, because that is where they see that they can earn a living.
All right.
I think that we need to address the concern that chronic fatigue syndrome is a viable area of research.
Yeah.
By demonstrating that there is funding for it and consistent funding for it. In the United States, several years ago, we had five centers of excellence. And then precipitously, the government just said, we're not doing this anymore.
And they were centers for research, for promoting research?
These were centers for research and clinical care spread throughout the United States.
Okay.
And the federal government, the National Institutes of Health, who funded it, decided they were just not going to do it anymore.
Right.
And so the centers closed.
Okay.
But the people who did the research in the centers, who were senior researchers, junior researchers, laboratory research associates, and technicians,
mm-hmm.
were then without funds. They were without salary.
Right.
So what were they to do? They were forced to go into other areas. And I suspect that if one ever did the study, they were loath to coming back.
Probably. Yeah. Well,
and
I understand we've established a new center in BC, in British Columbia, in Canada, for research into chronic fatigue, but I don't know any more about
it. And when it was done, I clipped the announcement of it that I received, and I sent it to the Centers for Disease Control, and I said, if British Columbia can do this, why can't we?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So I applaud British Columbia for its efforts, and I hope that other provinces in Canada can do the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that the Canadian experience will embarrass governments in other countries.
Very good.
To do the same.
I hope you're right. I appreciate all the time you spent with me. It's been a very thorough interview, and your commitment of time is quite welcome.
I hope that I have been able to both illuminate and also to provide hope and to provide inspiration and provoke enthusiasm of the chronic fatigue syndrome community that you serve.
Okay.
In chronic fatigue syndrome research and patient care. And to please not give up on us, the educators, the researchers, the clinicians, because we really are trying our best to meet the needs and advance the field of chronic fatigue syndrome.
And again, I thank you for your time.
You're quite welcome.
The American organization Pandora has introduced us to Dr. Kenneth Friedman, a professor in pharmacology and physiology, and a researcher in chronic fatigue who has been attending the conference in Ottawa in September of this year, talked to us about advances in both the treatment and the perspective of chronic fatigue syndrome in society. A different expression of Ken Friedman's insistence on the importance of activism. We tried to get the show going on disability access and the new AODA enforcement happening in January. No one was interested in talking about it. If you want to know who your biggest supporter is, look in the mirror. And to take us close to the end of the show, John Gorka, When You Walk In.
Heart is broken, your world a bitter place, your confidence shaken, your faith erased. What you depend on is up in the air. You want to move forward. and left you no good reason why. He wants a new life and you wanna die. He wants to be your friend and you can't be his. Tell him to go to hell, 'cause you already not hatred. There's no hate from him. The facts of indifference are cruel, with its pleasant skin and its brutal grin. How the world learns your name and it spins away. Of damage and wasted years, but love's never wasted, though it led you here. It might be the worst place you've ever been, still you light up a room when you walk in. You light up a room.
And in our final installment before the election of what to do if the curtailing of your special diet leaves your dinner short. Last week we made a beach, this week we'll make companions for the beach. For this you'll need toothpicks, pimento-stuffed olives, and bananas. Put the toothpicks in the bottom of the banana to form a tripod. Set the banana up so that it looks like a smile. Put a toothpick in either end and put olives on it. Now you have smiling eyes, too. These are your companions for the peanut butter beach that you built last week. Have a lot of fun with them. It's the most fun you're going to have with your benefits until somebody commits to raising the level of them so that you have enough to eat and restoring the special diet. See October 7th with the election results on Disrespect. If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.